This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In 1965, artist Andy Warhol was widely reported to have said, "In the future, everyone will be famous for 15 minutes." Fast forward 40 years, and it looks as if Warhol's quarter hour may have been a little too generous. The media landscape teems with 24-hour news coverage, hundreds of cable outlets, satellite radio, the infinite horizons of the internet, not to mention newspapers and magazines, all of them clamoring for fresh meat. Our society creates celebrities every day and then discards them like used Kleenex. A new book looks into that final stage of the celebrity life cycle. What happens when the cameras look elsewhere and the crowds move on? Later in the program, the persistent gaps in aviation security. But first, the 16th minute. Have you had your 15 minutes of fame? How did you deal with it afterwards? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. We also have an email challenge for you today. Send us the name of someone whose time is up and a line or two of advice you might have for them about how to resume a life of relative anonymity. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Again, someone whose 15 minutes of fame have expired and a little advice for them on how to get back to what we laughingly call the real world. Along with Douglas Perry, Jeff Gwynn is the author of The 16th Minute, Life in the Aftermath of Fame, and he joins us now from member station KERA in Dallas, Texas. And Jeff, nice to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you very much.
You mention, you begin your book with one character whose name will tug at the memories of a lot of the people listening, Melvin Dummer.
Melvin, I think, exemplifies when the modern age of celebrity began to rapidly expand and get us to the point where we are today. Now, if you're under, let's say, 30, you may vaguely remember a movie. But in the 1970s, briefly, Melvin Dummer, who wanted to be a country singer and songwriter, briefly became one of the most famous men in America just because of an accidental meeting in the Nevada desert in 1967.
And so anonymous, I mispronounced his name all of these years. Melvin Dummer ran into a guy he first thought was a bum who was about to freeze to death in the desert, who turned out to be Howard Hughes.
Well, at least that's the story Melvin's told since. Driving through the desert, stopping because, frankly, he'd had a little bit too much beer and needed to make a quick break, and finding an old man by the side of the road who wanted to be taken into Las Vegas. At least, again, in Melvin's story, the way he tells it, the elderly man identified himself as Howard Hughes, and some years later, when a reported will of Hughes's turned up, it left Melvin a considerable amount of Hughes's fortune, about $150 million. The mass media found this to be a terrific story, wrote all about it, including when a jury found the will must have been in fact forged, and Melvin became overnight a national laughingstock, and soon after that, forgotten.
He is one type of these 15-minute characters, if you will. Interestingly, you have another character in your book, Irene Cara, who Melvin Dummer, as you pronounce his name, I'm sure you'll correct me again. I think I got it wrong again. But he wanted to be a singer, and if he could only have one great big hit, he thought that would do it for him. Of course, Irene Cara, also in your book, did have that hit, and she's still in your book.
Well, when you think about it, people become celebrities in one of two ways. They either have happened into fame by accident, or they work toward it their whole lives, are very goal-oriented. Irene is in the latter category. She describes herself as a little ghetto princess who, from the time she could walk and talk, was being trained by her parents to perform. And yet, there are very few people who finally achieve celebrity, whether they meant to or not, who are able to hang on to it for a long, long time. In most cases, it's fleeting. With Irene, again, in the early and mid-80s, I would challenge most people to think of anyone who was a bigger pop star. We think we all remember Flashdance, What a Feeling, that great song that won her an Oscar, the movie Fame, in which she starred and I think was the breakout character. And yet now she lives in Florida. She's trying to put together a band and make it back again. Because she had it once, but not quite the way she envisioned it, she still believes she can get it back again, and this time on her own terms. And that, I think, is the trap of celebrity.
Well, people, you know, amazing things always do happen and have happened through history to people who were otherwise obscure. I mean, 15 minutes has happened before. Why such intensity, do you think, today? Just the volume of media?
Well, I think it really began to change. And let me preface this by saying we've always been a celebrity-obsessed culture. It's just that as the technology has evolved, it's become easier to feed our habit. In the mid-60s, for the first time, the vast majority of Americans had television. Previously, they had to follow the people they admired through the newspapers and magazines or on radio or by going to the movies and watching the little news clips before the main features. When you could actually see celebrities in your own home and on a pretty regular basis, that just lent itself to the real difference in the modern celebrity culture and what's gone before. Not only the opportunity to sort of feed on the lives of other famous people, but the idea that, gee, you just might be able to be famous yourself. And that is the big difference.
We're speaking with Jeff Gwynn, the author of The 16th Minute, co-author, I should say, Life in the Aftermath of Fame. Our number, if you'd like to join us, is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org, and we'll start with John. John's calling from Elmira, New York.
Hi, Neil. Two quick comments. You asked if the audience had a brush with fame. I was the host of a local AM radio talk show, morning DJ, for about a year and a half. And I can't escape the 16th minute because even though it's been close to 2 years since I went off the air, people still come up to me and ask me how the show's doing. But my vote for celebrity or erstwhile celebrity that's way into their 16th minute would be Gloria Allred. And taking Jeff's last comment, I really feel that she is someone who is just feeding off of this tabloid celebrity that you know we're so inundated with, and witness the two books that she's recently helping publicize, the one from Amber Fry on the Scott Peterson case, and then the one by Scott Peterson's long-lost sister. And I think this is just a person who, while I know she's a lawyer, she can't seem to stay out of the limelight.
Well, you better hope she stays in the limelight long enough so that her fame is reason enough that you can't libel her or slander her.
Well, talking just one more thing, and I'll go. What Jeff said about trying to cling on to it. I mean, I think were it not for her clients, she would have declined into that 16th and 17th minute herself. Thank you.
Okay, John. Thanks very much for the call. The idea of someone clinging on to celebrity, grabbing the spotlight and refusing to let it leave the stage.
Well, I think that's because celebrity, fame, for almost everyone who experiences it, does prove to be addictive. I wrote this book with a wonderful young writer who's an editor with the Oregonian newspaper, Douglas Perry, and he and I have talked about this at great length. The seven people featured in this book, in one way or another, were changed by their fame, and all but one admit in some ways that they found it to be addictive. Once you have it, the attention of strangers, every little minute detail of your life being fascinating to others, it's hard to give that up. I think Jerry Cooney, the boxer, is a wonderful example. He says that he always had a terrible self-image and that, like many celebrities, he engaged in self-destructive behavior because in some ways he didn't think he was deserving of all the love he got. And yet to this day, he admits what makes him feel he is a worthwhile human being is when strangers come up and ask to shake his hand or ask for his autograph. It's a way for people, well, any of us love praise, attention, and sometimes then celebrities seek it in less than positive ways because they can't do without it. And when it's gone, they turn on themselves. Cooney said, I think it's true, that many people think that fame is getting things. He defines fame as not having to deal with things. While you're famous, other people do that for you. Meaning, when the fame is gone, The celebrity is less able to deal with everyday life than us normal working class folks who had to learn how to handle life's problems as we went along.
Let's get another caller on the line. Mark is with us from Portland, Oregon.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
How you doing?
All right, you're on the air. Go ahead.
That's good to be on the show. It's interesting in that the word itself defined is, I think, misperceived by a lot of people. As I'm on hold here, our local public broadcasting has a background story going about people seeking fame and trying to find what it is. As a local astronomy educator, I found myself on the streets on a cross-country trip recently doing sidewalk astronomy and educating and entertaining people in the process. But I was constantly approached by people wondering why I was doing this for free. And as much as I was supported by my local astronomy club doing this, I was berated at times by people. And it was kind of interesting in that I was doing this for educational purposes, yet it turned into something that others saw me seeking as grandstanding or trying to gain fame for doing it.
Hmm.
It was unfortunate because my sole intention was to educate. Yet in the process, you get drawn into this where you start to receive recognition, and I think, as a local story was reported here in the Oregon area, what is fame? It apparently is something that we all desire in one way or another, yet it's not really part of the process and what I was doing. I fell into kind of a trap in doing this and found that local students found an interesting story to write their papers about, do their film projects about what I was doing. And I'm not the creator of this process that I was doing and exercising the educational process. I'm just somebody that was willing to do it. But in the process, I even got attacked by my own club locally. And I think there's an element of envy that comes into the picture, too, that many people are seeing you gaining this attention, and they envy it, and then some people will praise you, commend you, some will attack you for it.
Mark, thank you very much. It's a very interesting call. We got to take a short break, but we'll talk about the commodification of celebrity when we come back from a break. Thank you. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. We're talking about the 16th-minute life in the aftermath of fame. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the aftermath of fame, what author Jeff Gwynne calls the 16th minute. And here's another email challenge for you. Clips of two people featured in Jeff's book, people who were featured very prominently in the news, very probably in your lifetimes. Can you put names to these voices? Here's the first clip.
I am the principal enforcer of the rules of the House. And therefore, when the Speaker of the House is charged with having violated any rule of the House, it's a matter of some seriousness. And it's a matter that must be attended seriously and resolved promptly.
And here's another one.
The great thing for me was not this verdict. It was more that I got my day in court and I got to tell everything that I had been wanting to tell for years. I thanked Judge Howard today because he allowed us to tell the truth about Kenneth Starr. Not that all of America doesn't already know it, but that in a court of law it was proven that he was not seeking the truth.
If you can identify those voices, give us a call, 800-989-8255, or email us, totn@npr.org. We're talking with Jeff Gwynne, co-author of The 16th Minute, Life in the Aftermath of Fame. And it was curious, that call we had just before the break, Jeff, of a man who went out to do sidewalk astronomy, and people assumed that he was seeking the kind of celebrity you write about.
Well, I think that, again, tells us something about the nature of the celebrity-driven culture. Many people assume that it's the famous folks who are setting the agenda, when in fact it's the people who observe them, who are their fans, who look at them, who project onto them what they want to project. I think a great example of how something that may not be quite what it seems really marks the beginning of the current celebrity craze. And that's Andy Warhol in the 15 Minutes of Fame statement he supposedly made back in 65.
Mm-hmm.
There's a photographer, a great photographer named Nat Finkelstein, who at that time was renowned for his photography of civil rights demonstrations, who inadvertently became attached to Andy Warhol in the mid-60s in New York when Warhol wanted to become something more than just a regionally famous artist. Finkelstein took Warhol out into the New York streets to take photographs of this strange-looking guy in a normal everyday setting. And as legend had it, during that shoot, just when a certain photograph was being taken of Warhol, Warhol observed, as kids were trying to edge into the picture to get into it with him, a butcher with a bloody apron rushing out of his shop to get in the photo, everyone wants to be famous. And then he said, everybody will be famous for 15 minutes. Today, Nat Finkelstein recalls that, in fact, all Warhol said was, gee, Nat, everybody wants to be famous, and that he replied, yep, Andy, for 15 minutes they do. And that Warhol simply took that and used it himself from there on in. Yet we identify that with Warhol, with the modern celebrity culture, and it's one of the most famous sayings in American history, right up there with give me liberty or give me death.
By the way, you can read an account and see that famous picture of the moment that Warhol supposedly coined the 15 minutes phrase if you go to our website at npr.org. Again, you can take a look at the picture and see the account of that story, npr.org. Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Joan. Joan's calling from Scottsdale, Arizona.
Hi there.
Hi.
I'm so fascinated to hear the callers that called in. I've had a rather illustrious career. In my early 20s, I started as a talk show host of on a major market radio station in Boston, and then I went into television. And it's very sad that there's so much envy and jealousy in the world. I really identified with that fellow who was doing the astronomy work.
Mm-hmm.
And in the big picture of my life, I've had 15 minutes of fame that lasted about 5 years. And I was saying to the producer that I just found myself constantly competing with myself and wanting to be, quote-unquote, famous again. And when you get to the other side of it, it's very liberating because you realize that you really don't want it. And I'm so happy to be on the other side of it now and not be on a ferry going out to Nantucket with my family and have people come up and ask me about what it's like to work with Bill O'Reilly. You find that it's really not all it's cracked up to be. And I think our culture is definitely very obsessed with celebrity, and it's a sad and unfortunate thing.
Joan, let me ask you, there's a German word that's often used in these situations, Schadenfreude, taking joy in the bad experiences of others. Did you find that people enjoyed what they regarded as your downfall?
Well, that was mostly within the industry. I had to chuckle at the fellow who said he's been off the air 2 years and people are still asking him how the show's going. Because I've been off the radio for almost 24 years, and people still ask me, what was it like to work with so-and-so, and how what was it like to do this and that? And the public, I think, is much more loving, if you will. It's more the people within the industry that get jealous. And my heart just went out to that astronomer doing that good work and being attacked for it. But unfortunately, people are very... very jealous. There's a lot of jealousy out there. It's that. One thing I will say about being on the other side of celebrity is somebody was commenting about how everything was done for him. That's true. And when you're on the other side of it and you talk to people who say, oh, yeah, I used to have this guy come in and he expected us to give this for free and that for free, and here he is making $300,000 a year and he wanted and what an idiot, you know. And you get to the other side of it and you go, you know what, I was like that. And why should I be entitled more than anyone else just because I was on the radio or on television?
Well, Joan, welcome back to the radio.
Thank you.
Appreciate the
interesting conversation.
All right. Thanks very much.
Bye-bye now.
Betty Bishop of Chester, California writes, even local fame can be burdensome. I was on the school board for a while, and whenever some controversy was on the agenda, I could hardly pick up my mail at the post office because everyone wanted to stop me and give me their viewpoint. Not having that focus on me is just about the best part of not being on the board anymore. I can't imagine anyone who would want that sort of attention on a national or international level. You give up a good bit of your privacy. Well, Jeff Gwynn, a lot of people are willing to give up more than a good bit of their privacy to get that kind of attention.
And a lot of that may be because during their lifetimes, that was the focus of their existence. Now, in the 16th minute in the book, Kelly Clarkson, who I think a lot of the younger listeners out there will know anyway, talks about how that's what she wanted her whole life, how she and her friend would drag her mother into the room and watch them do a new dance routine every hour or so, that the purpose wasn't necessarily for Mom to like it, but that Mom should watch them. And now one of her big thrills is that the tabloids want to write about her. You hear about all these celebrities who say, oh, the tabloids, you know, the trash papers, the media, I hate it. And yet here you have a very intelligent, talented young woman who's thrilled and sees the fact the tabloids want to write about her as an affirmation of her fame. We're raising a whole generation of young people here whose goal may not be to become the greatest singer, the greatest actor, the greatest statesman in history, but to be one of the most famous, and that's an entirely different thing.
Andy Warhol may have made the 15 minutes of fame phenomenon famous, but Dr. Robert Millman named one of its psychological byproducts acquired situational narcissism. Dr. Millman is professor of psychiatry and public health at Cornell University's Weill Medical College in New York City. He joins us from his office there. It's nice to have you back on the program.
Thank you very much.
The last time you were on, you explained acquired situational narcissism. Remind us?
When someone is a great athlete from the age of 9, or a major entertainer from the age of 3 or 4, or even royalty, they get used to, when they walk into a room, everyone looks at them. And they stop looking out, so you become incredibly self-involved. And it relates to a pervasive feeling of grandiosity. Your achievements are great, your talents are great, and you expect to be recognized as such. You're special and you're unique, and actually the only other people who can know that are celebrities like yourself or people of great importance. You require excessive admiration. You don't give it back. And when the admiration falters, you often get very angry. You tend to be envious of other people in general. And I think a major issue of narcissism, whether it's acquired or you get it in the first few years of life, is empathy, lack of empathy. It's very difficult for you to put yourself in somebody else's place. So when you meet somebody, you're saying, who is he seeing? Who is she seeing? Am I as great? Do they understand how great I am? Rather than, who is that person? How can I get to know them?
Well, here's a person who's going to be very briefly famous, Joe Nodnicek of Pierre, South Dakota, who wrote in an answer to our contest, correctly identifying the voices of former Speaker of the House, Jim Wright, and Susan McDougall. Thanks very much for that, Joe, and congratulations. But Dr. Millman, in essence, I guess the 16th minute is when you lose the acquired situation. In that case, what happens to the narcissism?
My sense is that it must feel like the bottom drops out. Here you are, this person of remarkable accomplishment. Everyone knows how great you are. They've been giving you all these accolades. And then suddenly they're not giving it to you anymore, and you're not so famous, and nobody is interested very much in fawning over you as they did before. And I think what happens with some people with real pathologic narcissists is they plummet. They feel totally horrible. But I think anybody, after a moment of fame, when it goes, anyone would feel really terrible, as if the bottom dropped out. What's wrong with me? I'm not only not great, I might be the worst.
Let me ask you both, by the way. This weekend brought us the latest example of an instant celebrity, Ashley Smith, the woman who did absolutely nothing to bring this on herself. To the contrary, she spent hours held hostage by the suspected courthouse shooter in Atlanta. Obviously, she's already been through a lot. I wonder, do either of you have any advice on her 15 minutes will soon be up? Any advice for what she may do next? Dr. Millman?
It's hard to give advice to someone you don't know, but I would say stick to the things you know best. Stay with family and good friends. Try really hard to pay attention to who they are and how they understand you. And try not to ride too much on the wave of the admiration, the wave of celebrity.
Jeff Gwynn, she began by giving what's becoming rare in these circumstances, a news conference for everybody. She didn't sell her story to the National Enquirer.
I think that says something good about her. She has one advantage, though. Fame for her could have been a very tragic thing. She's going to come away with her life, and I'm sure she'll be grateful for that above all else.
The interesting thing, though, is that even people who have gotten their fame or their celebrity by virtue of a terrible thing, for example, children who are extremely disabled with cerebral palsy, for example, they often have a sense of celebrity and narcissism because they're so different from others. They feel everyone's looking at them when they look in, when they walk into a room or come into a room, and they stop looking back. And I think the danger is when you're not looking at who the other people are, when you lack empathy, when your sense of self-importance gets unduly exaggerated.
Robert Millman, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Millman, a professor of psychiatry and public health at Cornell University's Weill Medical College in New York City, credited with identifying and coining the syndrome known as acquired situational narcissism, and he joined us from his office in New York. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Jeff Gwynn, I did want to ask you, there are people who had their 15 minutes of fame. It's interesting. Irene Cara sang that title song, Fame, I Want to Live Forever. Well, interestingly, one of the co-writers of that song was Leslie Gore, who had her own 15 minutes of fame. It's My Party and I'll Cry If I Want To. And I think I may be one of the few who remembers It's Judy's Turn to Cry. But she and a lot of other people handle their 16th minute pretty well.
I think it was easier to handle a generation ago. Leslie Gore was a musical generation before Irene Cara. Again, the media, not just television, but now the internet, is so invasive, so pervasive. If you're famous, even briefly, there can be 10,000 websites in your honor that just appear almost overnight, bloggers commenting on everything they hear about you. But, you know, listening to the doctor and some of the things that he had to say made me wonder about this. You had someone correctly identify Jim Wright and Susan McDougall.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious, were there a lot of people who emailed or contacted you that were correct about Jim Wright?
I'm looking into the control room. Two got Jim Wright correct.
Well, let's think about that. There was a time when this man was one of the most powerful human beings in the world and one of the best known.
Third in line for the presidency.
That's right. And in fact, someone who was integral in Middle East conferences, Iran-Contra, he was in the center of that. Somebody whose power was almost unprecedented. And yet now, not all that many years after he fell from power, how many people seem to remember him? And think what that must be like for someone like him. It wasn't even a gold record that he lost. It was the ability to change history.
Let's get another caller on the line. Chris is with us from Galesburg, Michigan.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to comment on something I saw. It was when Joe Montana was still with the 49ers, and it was his last season. He'd been injured most of the year, and Steve Young was quarterback, and he just won a game to go into the playoffs. And Montana had been on the side dressed in uniform, and the game was over, and he put his helmet on and ran out on the field looking for a reporter to talk to him, and nobody wanted to talk to him.
Hmm.
He was running around like that, and I love Joe Montana and just saw how hard it must be to get over the drug of accolade, publicity, to be that high in a city, and then like that, you're yesterday's news.
Joe managed to swallow his hurt and go on and play for a couple of years for the Kansas City Chiefs.
Oh, yeah, and I love the guy. Don't get me wrong. It just was so painful because I loved him so much to see that happen. You know, you get used to everybody's wanting your attention, and I'm sure he didn't have to pay for any restaurant he went into or cab rides or anything, and then he goes to another city in order to try and regain some of that when he probably should have retired then.
Interesting. Chris, thanks very much.
Thank you.
One of the people that Jeff Gwynn writes about in his book is, a star athlete in his own right, Maury Wills, who set stolen base records and kind of changed the way that baseball saw itself, the nature of the game. We'll talk about him and some others who have lost their 15 minutes of fame when we come back from a short break. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK if you'd like to join us. Our email address is totn@npr.org. We'll also be talking about 3.5 years of improvements to airline security, yet reports still say flying is not as safe as it should be, where the problems are, what's being done to address them, that after the break. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now, we're wrapping up our conversation with Jeff Gwynn, co-author of The 16th Minute, Life in the Aftermath of Fame. And Jeff, just before the break, a caller mentioned the name of the site of Joe Montana in his last game as a San Francisco 49er. You profile Maury Wills, and Maury Wills, to be fair, had a lot more than 15 minutes of fame, a wonderful shortstop for the Los Angeles Dodgers for many years, one of the people whose stolen bases changed the way people looked at the game. Here's, you quote him, you hear some people, Maury Wills said, you hear some people, ones who used to be celebrities, saying that fame is addictive. For some of them, I guess that's true, but not for all of us. Fame was never my addiction. Constant striving for excellence was, and in a very selfish way. To get famous, you usually have to be selfish, putting whatever it is you are driven to do ahead of anything, anybody else. I'm going to tell you a story. I didn't tell it to show off. It just gives a good example of the way I was, and you go on to tell Maury Wills' story.
According to Maury, in the 1960s, when the Dodgers were at their peak as a team and he was one of the biggest stars in baseball, there was a crucial late-season series between the Dodgers and the San Francisco Giants. Wills insisted that his wife and children spend the baseball seasons living in Spokane. He didn't want them in Los Angeles because they might distract him from baseball. His wife Gertrude was pregnant and about to give birth. They knew the baby was a boy. In the clubhouse before the Giants series started, Wills got a telegram. It was from his doctor, his family doctor, saying his wife had fallen into a coma, and would Wills please get in touch? He didn't. The second telegram said the situation was worse. Now it was a matter of saving the life of the mother or the life of the baby. When could Maury be in Spokane? And he called the doctor and asked the doctor to make the decision. His wife was saved. The baby died. And Maury Wills played that series against the San Francisco Giants and played superbly. And he said that was what he was able to do in his pursuit of excellence. He could block anything else out. He didn't tell that story to make himself look good or terrible, for that matter. He wanted me to understand the way that he had been. That kind of obsession, even though Maury has trouble admitting it, simply was predicated on the fact that he wanted to be the best baseball player in the world, and he knew full well the best baseball players were also the most famous ones. Maury has struggled courageously through alcohol and drug addiction in his 16th minute, and now in his 70s, he's finally at a point where he can stop being so obsessive, he believes. Yet he still supports himself with his lingering celebrity at autograph appearances, different celebrity events, and so forth. And I think Maury's story exemplifies why Douglas Perry and I have tried to write a book that isn't an extension of People magazine, but actually an examination, not just of the celebrity culture, but at the focal point, the people who were and no longer essentially are. What they have gone through, what they learned, tells us a whole lot that we need to know about ourselves.
Let's get another caller on the line, and Robert is with us from Calgary in Alberta.
Well, actually, I'm down in southern Idaho right now, but I'm from Calgary, Alberta.
I thought you had a very powerful radio receiver there, but yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, actually, I'm an actor out of Canada. Now, I have acted in quite a few American and as well as Canadian productions. The most famous one I ever acted in, I'd have to say right now, would be Open Range with Kevin Costner. And I'm still kind of riding my, I haven't quite gotten to my 15th minute yet to go down on the 16th. But I realized early on, like I started in the film industry actually quite young when I was 9, doing background, stunt work and stuff like that. But I realized that this is something that wasn't going to last for me forever. So I turned around and went back to my first love, something that I always wanted to do from the time I was a little kid, which was drive an 18-wheeler.
Huh.
And surprisingly enough, would you believe that driving up and down the road, because when I'm not acting, that's what I do. I drive a truck. I get a lot of people that actually get angry at me because they find out how much I make as an actor, and they ask me, what the hell am I doing out here driving a truck? Hmm. And simply put, one, I'm not always going to be an actor. I'm not always going to have what the producers and directors want. Two, it's something that I really, really love and enjoy doing. I love driving truck. I've been a truck driver not as long as I've been an actor, but I've been a truck driver for 23 years, and I love it, and it's something that's always going to be there for me, whereas acting probably isn't going to always be there for me. But I also see...
Acting? The most stable of jobs? Come on.
Yeah, tell me about it. I mean, I'll always have local theater if I want it, but that won't always pay the bills there.
Well, it's interesting. Karl Malone, the now famous basketball player, and he's going to certainly go into the Hall of Fame and be famous forever, but Jeff Gwynn, he wants to be a truck driver too. Maybe there's something in it. Maybe that's the 17th minute.
Well, you know, it's always easy to say you want to do that, but I'll be curious if Karl actually gets behind the wheel once he's no longer known as a basketball player.
Robert, thanks for the call, and good luck in both of your careers.
No problem. You take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And Jeff Gwynn, we wish you the best of luck, and we hope you don't get too famous for writing this book.
Well, I hope that people pay attention to the book rather than the authors, because it's the subject that's more important.
Jeff Gwynn, along with Douglas Perry, are the authors of The 16th Minute, Life in the Aftermath of Fame. Jeff Gwynn joined us from the studios of member station KERA in Dallas, Texas. Thanks very much.
Thank you.